If you could turn, please, to Isaiah chapter 9. We'll read from verse 2 through verse 7. Now, I'm concluding the look at the Old Testament tonight. Those of you who come on a regular basis will know that we're flying over the Bible at 50,000 feet. We're just really trying to take in the big picture. And tonight we conclude our look at the Old Testament. So next week, as I say, the meeting's at Ashton, West Lancs Fellowship. The week after that, the 21st, I'll be in Rugby on Slavic Gospel Association business. And John will take the meeting that night. So when I come back on the 28th, Wednesday the 28th, it'll take us into the New Testament. Okay? So if you have Isaiah 9, verse 2, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined. You have multiplied the nation and increased its joy. They rejoice before you according to the joy of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For you have broken the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, as in the day of Midian. For every warrior's sandal from the noisy battle and garments rolled in blood will be used for burning and fuel of fire. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The seal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. Okay, now we've been looking at the prophets, and under the prophets we have looked at a new Exodus, a new temple, a new creation, a new covenant. And if you want to follow any of that up, you can look at it on the church website. You'll find it there, previous studies. But now tonight we're going to look at a new king. God had ruled through a king in the past. Now he's going to do it again in the new covenant era. And the prophets build on the promises that God had made to King David in 2 Samuel chapter 7. For example, what we've just read there in Isaiah 9 verses 6 and 7, you have the promise of the coming king. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The seal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. My friends, when you read that, and how often we read it? We read it a lot around Christmas time. But it is a mind-boggling thought. It's a fantastic concept. It's immense when you sit down and think about it. When you put your head on the pillow at night, my dear brother, dear sister, just remind yourself that you know the living God by his grace. That you know the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And that he knows you. And he knows your needs. And he is committed to your well-being. And he bears your name before the Father. And that despite everything that he knows about you and me. Because of all he is and because of all he has done, we are safe in the palm of his hand. What kind of king is this? Well, friends, he is altogether wonderful. And it's beyond our ability to convey it and relate it. as it should be conveyed. Daniel sees him as one like unto the Son of Man. So he's no ordinary king. The psalmist in Psalm 24, David, looks forward and he says, "Lift up your heads, O you gates, and be lifted up, you everlasting doors, and the King of Glory shall come in." And the question is asked, who is this King of Glory? And it's an antiphonal psalm. It's fantastic. You know, you get the picture of, you know, the one asking the question, who is the King of Glory? And the choir answers, well, it's the Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. And the exhortation, lift up your heads, O you gates, lift up you everlasting doors, and the King of Glory shall come in. And friends, we often sing the hymn, and the hymn captures it so well. In fact, we would have sung it tonight, only I think we sang it a number of weeks ago. Jesus shall reign where'er the sun doth his successive journeys run, and his kingdom stretch from shore to shore, till moon shall wax and wane no more. So the prophets, they spoke of a new covenant, and they speak of a new king, and they speak of a great blessing. The time of fulfillment, when this kingdom is ushered in all of its perfection, will be marked in a way that God's rule is established and everything falls into place. The peace and prosperity in which the world was, you know, initially created in all its pristine, you know, originality and glory, that will be restored. Probably that's the wrong phrase. It'll be restored beyond what it was when it was first created. It'll be certainly well elevated. But friends, that's the significance of Isaiah 11 that we touched on a few weeks ago. And that section around Isaiah 11, verse 6, you know, the reconciliation of old hostilities and the removal of all those old fears. And the new heaven and new earth, there'll be nothing to spoil or ruin or mar. Wars will cease. And in that psalm, depending on how you look at it, certainly it pictures the predators and the prey are hanging out together. The lions and the lambs are in the same little place, you know, giving us this wonderful picture of this new heaven and new earth where this king reigns. And there's actually a change of nature that is described not only in Isaiah 11 but also in Isaiah 66, insofar as when you read, you know, those passages, you read about the cow and the bear, you know, eating the same food. Now, I don't know much about cows and bears, but I don't think, you know, they're sharing the same diet. You know, I think you always get someone at the end of a meeting who knows these things, studied them and got degrees in universities, and they'll come up and say, well, actually, you know, bears and cows do eat the same diet. So I do stand to be corrected, okay? I'm not an authority on these things. But it also talks about the lion and the ox eating straw. Well, I think I can say with more of a degree of confidence, have you ever seen a lion eating straw? You see, what the picture is, friends, is that the curse of Genesis 3 is removed. And we read in those passages in Isaiah of the prophets, we read about the child playing with the serpent. You see, what I'm saying, friends, is that when God the King makes all things new, it's inconceivable for us to truly, really grasp what that will amount to. It will be glorious. So we come to Malachi. So we've really jumped to the end of the Old Testament, haven't we? Now, in 538 BC, 6 decades after the children of Judah had been carried away into Babylonian captivity, the return from the Babylonian captivity as prophesied by the prophets, takes place in part. Okay, there were three deportations into exile, and there are three phases of return. Now, we're in the Israel at this point, Israel and Nehemiah. It was during the time of Israel that Cyrus the Persian had come in. He had defeated the Babylonians, and he had introduced this whole resettlement process. Now, Cyrus doesn't let everyone go, and not everyone is able to go because of age, but he lets some people go. And Ezra and Zerubbabel, they go back, you know, to the promised land, and it appears to be this time of restoration. It's good, but it's not great. It's successful, but it's not as triumphant as the prophets had been suggesting. The numbers are small. The opposition, significant. And yes, they start to make an attempt to rebuild the temple. It takes them a considerable period of time. God's law is rediscovered. And Ezra begins to preach on the strength of all of that. And then, because of the opposition, etc., it all seems to sort of just peter out a bit. And then Nehemiah picks up where, you know, Ezra and Zerubbabel, etc., had left off. And Nehemiah hears the news about, you know, the walls of the temple, etc., still, and not the walls of the temple, the walls of Jerusalem still being knocked down. Things ain't good. It breaks his heart. He's crying in the court of the king. And anyway, the king sends him back. Okay, and he does this work of rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem. But those who had heard the story and knew about the story of the good old days, who are now working on the project of rebuilding the wall, realize as good as this project is, it doesn't seem to fit what people said what it was like before. And this temple doesn't even come close to the temple that Solomon had built. And nor does it even come anywhere near what Ezekiel was prophesying. And when you get to the end of the book of Nehemiah, chapter 13, you know, the book ends in disappointment, doesn't it? You know, Nehemiah's beating everybody up and turfing them out because, you know, they're not obeying the Sabbath laws. And it just seems to end in chaos. You know, such a great start. Such a great start with Nehemiah, but such a strange end. Now, it's at this time, post-exile, that the minor prophets Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi prophesy. And what they are saying is this. They're saying, well, basically, you know, we're saying the same that everybody else said before us. And they're saying, you know, the people went into exile because they disobeyed the law of God. They were rebellious. And we're going to say the same thing. If you keep breaking the covenant of God, God is going to come in judgment. My friends, as we have seen throughout our study of the Old Testament, or this overview of the Old Testament, the message is not just judgment. It's also a message of hope and a message of grace. They held out hope and they preached hope. They assured their listeners that God was going to act to fulfill his promise so that his people might enjoy all of the blessings that God had promised. Now, the Hebrew Old Testament doesn't end with Malachi. Okay? What book does the Hebrew Old Testament end with? You're not allowed to answer, John. Okay. What book does the Hebrew Old Testament end with? Any takers? Anybody know?
Isaiah?
No.
Daniel?
No. Jeremiah? No. I'll tell you. Hey, it ends with 2 Chronicles. That's the Jewish canon. The Old Testament ends with Chronicles. In fact, you remember when Jesus is talking about the death of righteous Abel through to righteous, who was it, Zechariah? That's the end of Chronicles. He's talking about the beginning and the end of the Old Testament there. So, now don't let that put you off. It's just the way our books are ordered. That Malachi, you know, comes at the end. But with the Hebrew canon, Second Chronicle concludes that canon, and it gives a promise that the exile is soon going to be over. Not like 538 BC, because that's not this great exodus that the prophets had speaking about all along. Spiritually speaking, the people are still in exile. They are waiting for the Lord to come and to fulfill his promise of salvation. God's kingdom still hasn't come in the way that the prophets have been speaking about it. And the answer is because God's king hasn't come. All the promises are still pointing forward to the coming king. But the last of the prophets, and in our canon, Old Testament canon, it's Malachi, the last of the prophets insists this king is going to appear. And he says in Malachi chapter 3, "See, I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me." And you get 400 silent years in that intertestamental period between the close of the Old Testament with Malachi and the opening of the New Testament with Matthew. 400 silent years. People are born. They go about their business, they work, they die, they're born, they work, you know, they die, they're born, etc. For 400 years. And people are saying to one another, you know, you could imagine, you know, 400 years after this, people are saying, what on earth is this all about? You know, this promise of sending a messenger. You know, it's all half a millennium. Millennium has almost passed, and we're still waiting. And then one day, a few of them are walking down, you know, into the market, and this strange-looking character with an odd outfit on and eating this strange diet. Even long before the WEF dreamed it up, a diet of bugs, you know, locusts and wild honey. And he's quoting Isaiah 40, verse 3. "The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God." And John the Baptist has come heralding the arrival of the king. And after John was put in prison, Jesus went into Galilee proclaiming what? Proclaiming the good news. Proclaiming the gospel. Proclaiming the good news of the kingdom. The kingdom of God, which for those who have been coming since the beginning will know that that is God's people in God's place. under God's rule, enjoying God's blessing. And we'll be able to take that up, the New Testament aspect of it, when we come back in a few weeks' time.